Hello. I'm delighted to be joined today by Rebecca Wardell, an Olympic heptathlete who has undertaken the most audacious journey to cycle from Lausanne to her native New Zealand, which is 20,000 kilometres. We're going to talk about the journey, the idea of setting goals, managing your mindset, and resilience in the face of unbelievable challenges. Rebecca, thank you for being here with us today.
Thanks, Heather, for having me. It's great to be here.
Can you tell us something about how this journey came about?
So it was really just a group of friends and I. So Sarah and Emma, who are also from New Zealand, we were all working together at the International Olympic Committee and here in Lausanne. And we used to go out on bike rides on the weekend, just as you do in the Swiss countryside. And somehow a discussion started about, hey, how about we cycle back to New Zealand? Or wouldn't it be amazing to do a long bike trip like this? Started just as a general chat, but somehow this idea kind of gained momentum. And before you knew it, we were all quitting our jobs at the IOC and packing our bags and starting off on an adventure that actually none of us had ever done anything like it before. So yeah, it just started as a very small seed of an idea in a very casual situation and quickly took legs.
That's a very small seed of an enormous journey. How do you go from having this small seed of an idea to a journey that I understand took you over 20,000 kilometres? Tell us a little bit about that process, if you will.
I think the three of us naturally, Emma being a gold medalist in single sculls and rowing at the Tokyo Olympic Games, and Sarah being a very high level athlete herself, myself also having competed at the Olympic Games, all three of us were always up for a challenge. And I think when you get three women together who are up for a challenge and wanting to push themselves, you're naturally creating an environment where things like this can quickly take off. I think key to this, though, was talking about it with family and friends, many of whom thought we were crazy.
But right, I can understand that.
Yeah, a lot of people were like, hey, wow, that's so cool. What a great idea. And I think once you've spoken something out loud to other people, it's very hard to kind of take it back. You've almost like you've committed or have a sense of responsibility to carry something through once you've spoken those words out loud. So that's how it took off initially, is just a personal adventure for the three of us. But then we realized very quickly that it was a great opportunity for us to make it bigger than just us, to add some social elements. So we decided to use our network in the Olympic movement. So every country has a National Olympic Committee. With the help of our colleagues at the IOC, we connected with the National Olympic Committee of each country that we would cycle through. So automatically we had a contact, which was great. It kept my mum sane. But we decided that we would connect with school children in every country that we cycled through to inspire, tell a story, speak about the Olympic movement, speak about geography, culture, and really kind of open their eyes. To also connect with Olympic athletes in each of the countries we cycled through, so to understand more about their training, their upbringing, how they became Olympians, their role in their communities. And we would bring the local Olympian to the school visit with us to really bring that kind of connection. And then the third element was we chose a charity in New Zealand that aims to empower young women, so teenage girls, to really be leaders in their communities through sport. So to give them opportunities to really grow and find confidence. And we set a target of raising $1 per kilometre and ended up raising in excess of 27,000 New Zealand dollars. So it started as a small seed of three girls just wanting to have an adventure and a good time, and very quickly grew into this really big project, which had a lot of meaning and purpose behind it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what I hear you say is the moving from that seed of amongst an idea amongst friends to actually really becoming something much more purposeful to help to keep young girls motivated to stay in sport, to develop their abilities through sport. In some ways, using yourselves as role models as women athletes who have reached really high levels.
Yeah.
And growing from that small seed of an idea between you three, what I'm hearing is that you use the power of conversation and networks within your community and within the International Olympic Committee world to actually federate this idea and grow it to a purpose that was much more than the three of you on a cycle ride.
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly.
Okay, and tell us something about some of the challenges that you encountered along the way.
So it's funny, when I look back now, I kind of, it's easy to gloss over the challenges because you kind of just see the journey and people see the nice images and things like this. But there were some really, really dark moments. Even right from the first day when we cycled from Lausanne to Brig. Initially we hadn't planned on going to Brig. It's 160 kilometers from Lausanne. But we were all excited and we had a tailwind and we're like, oh, this is great, let's just keep going. But very quickly, just as we passed Sion, we turned into a massive headwind. We were riding bikes that were 42 kilograms, which none of us had ever ridden before. And very quickly, I was like, what am I doing? This is day one and it's going to be tough like this. These tough moments are going to continue on. But having that support, the two girls with me, Emma and Sarah, and also the incredible support that we'd had when we left Lausanne, focusing on that and thinking back to all these people who are behind us who'd just given us a great send off, really just gave us that really good feeling that, okay, it's okay. It's day one, things are going to be a bit tricky, but we just need to keep our heads up and really focus on the good parts of the journey.
And what happened next after you realized the bikes were heavy? They're 42 kilos. You'd done 160 kilometers on day one, and your mind is saying, "What am I doing?" What happened next for you to continue?
I mean, for me, a lot of it was about, I had to kind of focus on the positives of the journey. I had to focus on the school kids that we were going to be meeting, the money that we were raising for the charity, for the Olympic athletes that we were going to visit. And I really wanted, especially for the schools in New Zealand where I had a real connection, was to be able to go into those situations and really tell a story of resilience, of perseverance, of things got tough, but we survived and made it through to the end. And I focused a lot on that in those tough moments, was like, okay, this is bad, but it will end. The mud will go away, the snow will stop, the ice will melt, the headwind will turn into a tailwind. All of these horrendous conditions that we rode through. For me, it was really to focus on those moments where we could inspire others, the bigger purpose of the journey, and try to really focus on those things to get us through the tough moments and be able to stand in front of these people with a sense of pride and achievement, and really tell an incredible story.
And what was important for you about inspiring those girls and those children through this story? What was the importance of that?
I think for me personally, growing up, I'd been inspired by Olympic athletes, adventurers, people who'd gone out and done something that was out of their comfort zone, out of the box, something where they'd really challenged themselves and either succeeded or failed. I think in both instances, it's an incredible story, and it's about the journey. Whether someone wins an Olympic gold medal or doesn't quite make the team, they still have these incredible stories. And I wanted to be able to maybe give back, is a good way of putting it, give back to the younger generation and sort of give some of these kids that we were going to visit a little glimmer of, oh, maybe if I can do this or that, I can achieve something, or just to show them that the impossible is possible sometimes. But if you don't quite achieve the goal that you set to, you can have an incredible experience and journey along the way, and ultimately grow and become stronger as a person, I guess, is the number one takeaway.
Yeah, so what you're saying really epitomizes this idea of the growth mindset that we hear talked about so much in society today. And it's a concept that, of course, is being used quite significantly in schools to encourage both teachers and children to recognize that learning isn't fixed and our talents and abilities aren't fixed when we're born, and that our achievements are the sum of those fixed abilities that we have. And yet many, many people do grow up with this mindset that actually we have a quotient of intelligence, a quotient of abilities in particular areas, And I think what you're talking about really epitomizes this idea of the growth mindset, that we can challenge ourselves to go beyond,
exactly,
to embrace difficulties and to grow through that experience.
Yeah. And I think what was crucial for us too in these messages with the people we met along the way, the children in particular, was not to say you have to go and cycle across the world. I mean, we were very privileged to be in a position to be able to do something like that. It's that in your own world, in your own context, you can push yourself, you can learn from your mistakes, you can set goals and achieve them or fail and still get something out of it. We were very careful to not pass on a message that you have to be doing something absolutely crazy. It's I think you can build resilience and perseverance in a vast array of different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really important point, because of course not everybody is going to be crazy enough to want to cycle 20,000 kilometers across the world.
Yeah.
But there is this wonderful idea of setting a really audacious challenge, and then even if we feel perhaps ill-equipped or unready to be able to take it on, to find that inner strength to embrace the challenge and continue.
Exactly.
The journey.
And I think for us in particular, the goal setting process was incredible and was also very applicable to anyone who was sort of following us. You know, we set the big goal, okay, we cycle from Lausanne to New Zealand. But for me in particular and the girls as well, to manage that mentally, it was very tough to sort of think, oh my gosh, I've got to cycle 20,000 kilometres. That's just, your brain kind of doesn't compute it. But if we, you know, we thought, oh, 5 more kilometres and we get to have a coffee, you know,
right,
30 more kilometres and it's lunchtime, 1 more week of this and we have a rest day, 4 more weeks and we're in a new country, you know, just those very, very small chunks that are manageable in your head. Before you know it, you've done 1,000 kilometers. Before you know it, you've done 10,000, and then it kind of continues. And especially when things were really tough, when the conditions were awful, you know, saying, okay, every 2 kilometers we're going to stop and have a Snickers bar, it just, before you know it, it had passed. And I think passing on those goal setting messages to other people who we met was an incredible part of the journey as well.
I think it's a beautiful message also for those of us in leadership roles, because often the path forward seems long, mm-hmm, and uncertain and unknown. And yet how do we make progress into the unknown? And I'm hearing you talking about plans, mm-hmm, and then small steps along the way to be able to reach the goal of 20,000 kilometers.
Yeah.
So there's a sense of kind of having a plan, but also path finding along the way.
Totally. And then flexibility, Heather, was key. I mean, it would have been very easy to sit in Lausanne and literally draw on a map where
right,
we wanted to go. But I mean, we knew that, you know, this road might be closed, or a local person might suggest this is a better route, or this kind of stuff. We had fixed points in terms of visas, that we had to, you know, be out of a country by a certain time due to visas. But apart from that, we knew that we had to be flexible according to conditions, weather conditions, road conditions. And I think this is applicable in any project. If you're very fixed, you can get into trouble, because I was going to go down that road.
Right.
And now it's closed. Oh, what do I do? Whereas if you have a bit of a flexible mindset, it's like, okay, no problem. We'll just take road B, for example. So yeah, it was being able to be flexible, which for myself, I struggled a little bit with, because from my athlete days in track and field, heptathlon, things were very fixed. It's a much more structured kind of environment, high performance, you know, down to the minuscule, what am I eating today? When am I sleeping? When am I having a massage, physio, training? Things were very, very structured. So for me, I had to let go a little bit of that in order to sort of cope, I guess, on a journey like this.
So the idea of actually having to let go of a certain amount of fixed view of what would happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm hearing you talking about carrying that discipline with you that perhaps you built during your days as an athlete to have the discipline to be able to make those steps of progress, even when you may not have felt like it.
Yeah, exactly. Especially when I was an athlete, you know, coping with injury and these kind of things, trying to overcome this, to realize that there were ways around injury. There were different ways that we could train. It wasn't the end of the journey, so to speak. A lot of the learnings from my kind of athlete career around resilience, perseverance, goal setting were crucial, I think, in achieving a trip like the bike ride that we did.
Yeah, so let me go back a moment to going from the seed to the journey.
Mm-hmm.
Take us through a little bit how you went through some of the planning, mm-hmm. from idea germination to setting off on your bike. What were some of the steps that happened? What were some of the things that you feel are really important to setting yourselves up for success?
Yeah, well, I mean, number one was to build a team around us to support us. Me alone, I never would have taken off on a trip like this, mm-hmm. on my own. As soon as Sarah and Emma were like, we're in, I think, you know, to have two friends who you trust with your life to you know, jump on a bike and do something crazy like this with was unreal. And when they agreed, I mean, it was a once in a lifetime opportunity that you couldn't put down. But having said that, us three needed a whole wider group of people around us. We had our colleagues at work who were setting up the meetings with the National Olympic committees. We had our friends and family who were helping us with, you know, setting up connections with trying to get sponsorship in terms of clothing or bikes and things. We relied very heavily on networks of cycle tourists who'd done similar trips to get advice on what do we pack, you know, what's a good route, this kind of thing. There were lots of amazing communities online that we joined. So it was a whole army of people who were behind us on that journey. And when the moments were tough, it was that army who was sort of pushing us along through the headwinds and that kind of thing. And it was an incredible sense to know that you had this really great support behind us.
So it's very different from the image I might have in my mind of a woman on a bike going across the middle of Central Asia to New Zealand, to thinking of that whole support system and how important that was for you along the way.
Yeah, and even Heather, not just the support system that we set up from the start, but along the way, the people that we met, we relied very heavily on strangers for support. And actually, one of the key takeaways for me from the journey was the incredible kindness of strangers. The doors that opened and the people that helped us out were just absolutely phenomenal. In the most backwards parts of Tajikistan, we had, you know, people running out of their yurts or running off the fields they were working in, inviting us into their homes for tea, coffee, stay the night. And these people had nothing, like they're subsistence farmers, and the generosity and kindness of spirit from these kind of people just blew us away and made the whole journey so much more rich and rewarding. But also they saved us a lot from sort of camping in dire conditions and things. So it was a network of people who we knew, who knew us, but also an incredible network of people literally the whole way along the journey who held us up.
So the network of those who were known to us and the network of those that were waiting to know.
Yeah.
Can you give an example of the kindness of strangers along the journey that particularly touched you?
Yeah, we had one night we were in Tajikistan and we'd just climbed the highest pass of the trip, so 4,600 meters, so sort of the height of Mont Blanc, super tired, freezing cold, exhausted from climbing. And we were thinking we were going to have to camp because on the map we couldn't see, there was no towns or anything. Cycling along, starting to get dark, and we came across in the distance, you could see a yurt on the side of the road. And as we approached it, this woman came running out and she was absolutely fantastic. She insisted on us coming inside. She was amazing. It was literally, the yurt was just a one room with a small kind of potbelly stove in it where her and her husband were, they lived there. That was their life. There was a couple of yaks tied outside and she took great pleasure in sort of cooking us instant noodles. And of course, she doesn't speak English. We didn't speak the local language. But through common things, we had a couple of photos of family you could show. This is my mum, this is my dad. Through sign language and a little bit of kind of body language, you could somehow have a conversation. She went outside and milked the yaks and brought inside this sort of steaming pail of hot yaks milk and added some sort of oil and bread and stirred it up and gave it to us. And we'd become by then quite good at sort of being polite at trying to eat a little bit and then leaving the left beside. But just, it really struck me that she was helping us. I mean, she was, we were in a nice, cozy kind of away from the elements. She was feeding us. But in accepting her offer of help, we were helping her. Like, she just had, you could see the joy she was getting from being of assistance, from hosting us. And I think for me personally, that was a really strong takeaway and something, you know, I would never, if I saw a cyclist here on my street in Lausanne, I would never run out and be like, hey, do you want to come inside and let me feed you? I just, these people have so much to offer in the way that they operate, the way they're so generous and hospitable. It really opened my eyes to, I think, how we can maybe be a little bit more like that. Or, yeah, it was mind-blowing. And that was not an isolated incident. This continued in almost every country.
So the kindness of strangers, and what I'm also hearing is the ability to communicate even without words.
Exactly.
So the ability to communicate the emotion, the connection when there's a desire to do so. And of course, when with the world being so polarized in many areas in terms of when we do use words, mm-hmm. this is a wonderful reminder of how when we speak with the heart, we actually really are able to connect with people.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously we traveled through so many different countries, so many different cultures, but there's a common thread through all these cultures that everyone understands. And I think, you know, family, food, shelter, you know, the basic needs of all humans. And that's something that I've actually taken away with me now into my personal life, into my work life, because obviously at the IOC we work a lot with different cultures, with the different organizing committees. There's a lot of different cultures within the organization itself. And just, you can really quickly form bonds with people from completely different cultures by chatting about the commonalities. And really, it's amazing the richness you can get out of it. Because it's kind of easy to be a little bit dismissive of people who you don't understand, who are very different from you. You kind of think, oh, they don't have much to offer, or I can't be bothered. But it's amazing once you kind of get over that and dig in, you can just, I mean, you can have friends for life from people who have grown up in completely different ways. And it was just incredible.
Yes, it really highlights when we think about diversity, equity and inclusion. Mm-hmm. We talk about that a lot in organizations, of course, mm-hmm. today. And it seems like the main focus was on not on seeing the differences, but about seeing the commonalities of humanity.
Totally.
And connecting on that level.
Yeah. And for us too, being very conscious of our kind of bias that had come from the way we'd grown up, and sort of Western focus, Western media that we absorb and consume every day. And then to travel through countries like Iran, which is, you know, not, or some of the stans, which are not painted in the best light in some of our Western media, and then to be in their cultures and their communities, and them to sort of say, you know, please tell everyone that Iran's great, you know, tell your friends, tell your family. And these people were the most kind and generous. You know, we had an accident in Iran, so both Sarah and I fell off our bikes and were injured. I ended up with stitches in my knee. She ended up with a sprained ankle and knee, and we ended up having 2 weeks basically resting and recuperating. These guys were paying for our medical bills, driving us to physio, feeding us. And the experience that we had in Iran in particular was the polar opposite from what you see on a daily basis. And even, you know, friends and family, do you think it's safe? I don't know if you maybe shouldn't go through Iran, all this kind of stuff. So just that eye-opening and giving them the opportunity to show who they are as a culture and people was something that I think I'll value for the rest of my life.
It's a beautiful story about how the mental images we have in our head, whether mm-hmm. they be from the media or from our own upbringing or our own biases, can be quite distorted in terms of the reality of the people that we meet in the world.
Yeah, and I think just having a conscious sort of thought that to kind of try and look past that and see the person for who they are. And again, going back to those commonalities, I think, yeah, we can learn a lot.
Was there any time and occasion where you felt fearful for your own safety? I could imagine that in over a year and 20,000 kilometres, there may have been one or two occasions.
There were one or two. We kept them pretty quiet, mainly for our mother's sake, so that they weren't too worried. But no, I mean, a lot of the fears for safety were around the road itself, you know, big trucks, dangerous conditions to cycle in. this kind of stuff. We also, just before we, 2 weeks before we arrived in Tajikistan, there'd been a terrorist incident where a group of cyclists had been murdered. The same as us, literally cycle tourists. I think they were Dutch, Swiss and American in a little group. I mean, it easily could have been us. They were going down a path or a road that we'd initially chosen to do. There was a bit of soul searching at that point in the trip because we were in Uzbekistan at the time and Tajikistan was our next country. Do we continue? Do we change our plans? Do we, you know, go into a different country? In the end, we decided that Tajikistan was going to be one of the highlights of the trip. We'd heard so many good things about it. We changed our route. We didn't go down that, but we kind of had the thought that, you know, if we don't go to Tajikistan, then the terrorists have kind of won. You know, they've got the upper hand. Whereas maybe we were silly in hindsight, but we decided to go on through. Given that, we still had a little bit of, you know, every time a car was sort of coming up a bit close behind, or you sort of had that, oh, you know, is this safe? What are we doing? But as per the story of the woman in the yurt, we experienced the complete opposite from the people in Tajikistan. It was warmth, friendship, generosity, just this incredible country. And it actually ended up being my favorite country of the whole journey.
Gosh.
Yeah.
That's an inspiring story.
Yeah.
And actually, if we think about that in relation to resilience, one of the key components of resilience, of course, is self-regulation, how mm-hmm. we manage ourselves, perhaps under stress, how we mm-hmm. manage to reframe a situation. How did you do that? How did you really shift your mind from focusing on the fear of potentially what might happen and what had recently happened to focusing on moving forward in the way you did?
Yeah, I mean, we had a lot of support from family and friends. Again, they were crucial to sort of, you know, it's okay, you guys are going to be okay. And the local people helped us to kind of really feel safe and comfortable. And for us, it was just to kind of tap into that. You know, it'd be very easy to sort of focus on the negative, the fear. And instead, we tried to really tap into the positive aspects of the journey. Maybe just to highlight that I don't think we were being reckless. We were always very cautious and made a very calculated decision, mm-hmm. I think there's a difference between resilience and recklessness.
Yes, good point.
Throughout the whole trip, we made sure that we tried to walk on the other side of that line. For example, everyone had told us that cycling into Istanbul was really dangerous. So instead of being like, no, we're going to cycle the whole way, we're like, okay, thank you for the advice. We'll take a ferry in. Mm-hmm. So there was just, you know, some elements like that where you had to take people's advice, not be so stubborn, and then just enjoy the experience of being on a ferry, you know, just enjoy that positive aspect of it.
A moment of tourism.
Exactly. Sit back and watch the world go by.
I've heard resilience described as something from which typically we bounce back from. So it's the idea that maybe something sets us back and then we're able to bounce back and recover. I've also heard it described as the ability to bounce forward, so to project ourselves forward from a particularly difficult situation.
Mm-hmm.
I think the way I like to think of it the most is the ability to bounce with the changes that are coming our way. And this is a lovely example of bouncing with some of those changes that came your way rather than resisting them too much or
exactly.
Ignoring them.
Yeah, and actually the nature of the ride itself, when the going got tough, moving forward was the way out of it. If it was snowing, if you stopped and just stood on the side of the road, well, you're just going to get soaked and freezing cold. Whereas if you keep moving, eventually it got better. You found somewhere to shelter or the snow stopped. And I think this was really hard. You know, there were some mornings where you just didn't want to get out of bed. If you found a nice, cozy place to sleep and it was snowing outside, you didn't want to jump on your bike. But you just knew that we just had to keep moving. Obviously, we had the pressure of, you know, visas and a few time restrictions like that. But the longer you just sort of stay in bed and be cozy and comforting, you eventually have to get out there. So we were just like, we just might as well rip the Band-Aid off and keep moving. And by keeping moving, it gave us the energy. It gave us the sense that we were doing something to overcome the road conditions or the weather conditions. You were sort of being active in the way you were dealing with the situation. Whereas if you just stop and do nothing, it kind of overwhelms you. Whereas I think action, at least you feel like you're doing something to address the problem.
Yeah, so it sounds like a nice combination of kind of recovery and rest time, and then managing your energy, your physical, your emotional, your mental energy by taking that, getting on the bike, by moving forward. And
yeah.
Of course, for you, it was literally moving forward, literally. One pedal at a time.
Yeah.
And perhaps for executives, there's a parallel there, almost in a metaphorical sense, that our energy can get stuck if we stop moving, and we don't keep ourselves going through situations.
Yeah, exactly.
How did you get through some of the rougher moments of the journey?
I mean, we had some pretty tough times in Western China in particular. We had this, it's a massive desert, not a lot of towns, very difficult to find accommodation. There was literally a highway that ran through the desert. And we spent a lot of nights sleeping in drains under the highway purely because we wanted to be out of sight of the traffic. You know, you didn't want to sort of pitch your tent
right
next to the road. So under the road was the only place that was sort of vaguely hidden from the sight of the traffic. You know, howling wind, rats, you're in a drain. And this was sort of 6 months into the journey, kind of like, what am I doing here sleeping in a drain in China? Like, is this worth it? It'd be very easy. We'd heard a lot of other cycle tourists had sort of taken a train through that part of China or a bus or but again, to come back to the story of the people who were supporting us, the children we were speaking to, We wanted to sort of give that message of resilience, of getting through those tough times rather than kind of taking the easy road out without, as I said before, being reckless. It's only a tent in a drain. There's no crocodiles, and you know, it's, you can endure this stuff, right? It's just a bit of mind over matter. Go to sleep and eventually wake up and you're out of it. It's interesting how you can kind of get used to it, you know, by sort of after a month of that, you're kind of like, oh yeah, that drain looks nice. That one looks nicer than that one. And it's incredible how it gives you amazing perspective of appreciating now being able to go home and have a hot shower and a warm bed. And it's funny because the core of every day on the bike trip was find somewhere to sleep, find something to eat, and don't get lost. And these are three things that in your daily life,
you don't think about.
You never think about it. You know where home is, you know where the supermarket is, and you've got a warm bed to go to and a hot shower. So it was really, really fascinating to have to go back to basics and just realize that you can survive without a hot shower and you can survive sleeping in a drain, and that it then makes you so much more grateful for what you do have when you have those comforts.
I think it's what you're sharing is a beautiful example of this ability to take different perspectives. And often one of the ways in which we as humans stay stuck is we get a little fixed in the way we look at things.
Yeah.
And this is pretty extreme, I have to say, sleeping in a drain with the rats around you, but nevertheless a really nice example of that perspective taking.
Yeah, and it's funny, we had a saying, it could be worse. And so whenever something was awful, I mean, there was one day in China again where the road just literally turned to mud. It was like kind of knee deep, and you're trying to push a 42 kilogram bike through this mud that was impossible to ride. We just kept saying it could be worse, and we're kind of chatting like, oh, imagine if it was, you know, imagine if it was snowing, or imagine if our bike was 100 kilos, or imagine this and imagine that. And we tried to make light of the situation by always, whenever we had these rough moments, saying, oh, at least it's not that, which is funny how just that little change in mindset can really make a massive difference.
I'm grateful that you share that, because a lot of the ways that we are able to manage our mindset is, of course, how we talk to ourselves and how we talk out loud. So language is really important in terms of how we manage mindset, and having that mantra, it could be worse.
Absolutely.
Both a perspective, but it's also a really nice example of focusing on the positive, which of course is another key component of resilience, to be able to focus on the positive, even when the going gets tough.
Definitely. And I mean, I don't want to sound like we had it all sorted.
No, it doesn't sound like it.
There were several times crying and, you know, despair, moments of real darkness and just huge questioning about what we were doing. I remember calling a few friends being like, oh, this is terrible. And they're like, well, just stop. No one's forcing you to do this. If it's that bad, pack your bike in a box and come home. And it's funny how them saying that to me kind of made me go, oh, you know, that's okay. I'll, you know, that to me, that sounded like kind of defeat, like giving in, and was just enough to kind of snap me out of my woe is me and tears and things, and to kind of get back on track. Because in the end, no one was forcing it. It's the whole thing was our idea, and really, if it's your idea, you can't really complain too much about the situation that you've put yourself in.
Tell us something about what it was like when you reached New Zealand and you were able to connect with the children that you wanted to see, and how did that evolve?
So it was fantastic. It was some of the best memories of the trip. So with the New Zealand Olympic Committee, arranged 40 different school visits throughout my trip through New Zealand. And actually it kind of changed the dynamic a lot, because these school visits all had to be planned. You know, you need to turn up at the school at 11:30 and the next one at 3:30. So we'd just kind of been rolling through countries with not really much of an agenda. In New Zealand, I was on my own. So all of a sudden I still thoroughly enjoyed it, but it was very much a business journey of these school visits. It provided some really nice structure and was so rewarding, because for me, I grew up on a farm in South Island of New Zealand, middle of nowhere, a very small country school. So to be able to go into a school in New Zealand and sort of say, I grew up just like you, this is what I've done. Not again to say that they had to do something crazy like this, but just to sort of sow the seed that I was, when I was their age, we were exactly the same. Whereas that didn't really fly in, you know, in the school in China, or of course a little bit, but there was a real connection that I could make. These kids are like, oh, she's from New Zealand, we're from New Zealand, this is cool. And we didn't have that in the other schools. So that was the real kind of richness of it. And I also had lots of family, friends, places to stay, people who rode with me. Yeah, it was an incredibly special thing. And also to cycle on roads that I'd driven. I saw many parts of New Zealand I'd never been to, which was incredible. So I kind of felt like I could explore my own country, which was also really nice.
Fantastic. Is there anything else you'd like to share, if there are sort of two or three key insights, you know, key things that you can share that might be helpful for people in the business world or working in organizations?
I mean, for me, as I said earlier, some of the key takeaways from the journey, the kindness of strangers absolutely blew us away, something that we never really thought about or expected until we were kind of in it. And in countries where you wouldn't have expected it was something that I still think about now in my daily interaction with strangers, is, you know, I need to pay it back, all these amazing people who helped me out. And I think just through your daily life, it's a nice sort of thought, is, hey, maybe that person would like me to open the door or say hello or pass you a glass of water, or just these tiny little things that you can do for people who you have no idea who they are can make the world of difference. The other thing I think would be key would be to say, if you have a kind of itch about an idea or a project, is have a go, like see where it goes. Talk to some like-minded people about it. Talk to some people who aren't like-minded about it.
Right.
See if it will grow into something that could take legs and gather a support team of people around you who believe in your project or your idea, and also believe in you as the person driving behind it. Because as I said earlier, having that crew around us was something we could never have done without. It was not just three women cycling across the world. It was a massive group of people, and this is key, I think, to the success of any project, is the community that you build around you.
Yes, wise words, I think, to bring our conversation to an end. The importance of strangers, and particularly the kindness of strangers. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's implicit, I think, in what you've said is the need to ask for help.
Mm-hmm.
And something that many of us perhaps could do with a little bit of a nudge in that direction, that actually if we ask for help, it's amazing how often it is provided. And so many executives we see perhaps have a harder time asking for help. But when you ask, there's an enormous benefit that comes your way.
Yeah, definitely. And just looking around your team members and the people who surround you, people who you may have thought they don't have anything to offer. Sometimes these people have amazing insights from a completely different perspective and different cultures and things. And I think it's just being open-minded about what's going on around you and drawing on those resources to really take your project to the next level.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the conversation. And thank you for joining us. This is a conversation with Rebecca Waddell, who has offered an inspiring story about not only having been an Olympic athlete, but also having had the audacious goal and dream to cycle from Lausanne to New Zealand, not only as a personal challenge, but as a way to inspire the next generation to look at role models, to see what they can take from inspiring stories to engender resilience and courage. So thank you.
Thank you, Heather.